Bienvenidos and welcome to the Jacobin Sports Show. I'm your host, Matthew Miranda. I'm excited very much for today's episode. You will see why in a matter of moments. Before I kick it off, I just want to answer a question that was posed via Twitter from the user Wish in One Hand, excellent New York Rangers fan, who asked about the outro music, wanted to know why does the show end with that beautiful, beautiful outro music that it ends with. If you're not familiar with the tune, it is the Adagio from Spartacus. It's by the great, I think, Armenian composer, Khachaturian. Why is that the outro music? Because I put a lot of thought into everything that I do in life. And that's just always, I don't actually remember Spartacus. I don't even know if, it's a beautiful song, man. Like, it sounds like you are literally ascending into a newer state, a higher state of some kind. And that's the vibe I want you to have at the end of every episode. I want you to feel like you have ascended into some kind of a slightly higher plane, thus Khachaturian's Adagio from Spartacus. So that is the mystery of the outro music. We're going to get right into today's episode. Today's episode features a very special guest, by which I mean, in one sense, the least special guest we could have, because this person is not a guest. This person is one of the originators, the inspirations, a founding father, if you will, of the Jacobin Sports Show. Now back for the first time in many moons, we are happy to welcome Jonah Birch back to the Jacobin Sports Show. Jonah Birch, how do we find you on this main
Life is good. Life is good.
I have to tell you, it's sad for you people at home that this is an audio pod, because Jonah is looking very sexy today. He's got a little bit of Indiana Jones stubble, just a little bit.
Yeah.
But it is a sight to behold.
People say that I have a real Harrison Ford vibe. Maybe Harrison Ford in Witness. Maybe Harrison Ford in Indiana Jones.
There are the professor scenes. I can see that.
Yeah.
I can see young sociologists blinking messages at you on their eyelids.
Sitting just in the front row. Yeah. Definitely. Anyway.
The people want to know, how is Jonah Birch doing?
He's doing great. He's doing great. I'm going to refer to myself in the third person. It's wonderful to be in New York City this time of year. Mm-hmm. The birds are chirping. The children are laughing, and all is right with the world, you know, except for the New York Knicks, but otherwise.
So we can get to the postmortem of the Knicks in a bit, but there are teams that are still alive, including, and I don't know what your thinking was going into game six, but your Boston Celtics, who I remember very specifically asking you at the start of the year, did the Philadelphia 76ers concern Jonah Birch at all? No. I'm not afraid of them. Bring it. When they were down 3-2, were you nervous?
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, okay. That game was an emotional roller coaster of really.
That was some game.
Yeah, I mean, I was so sure. Of course, everyone was, that they were going to lose when they were down by two, and you know, mm-hmm. they had the clear path foul that the refs let Embiid take the foul shots on, and really bizarre situation. So, of course, I mean, I do have to say, it feels like, you know, Philadelphia is a really good team, and you know, unlike in past seasons, it obviously Celtics have not dominated the series, and for a number of reasons. I mean, one, I think Philly has done a better job protecting the ball with Embiid, right? You know, limiting turnovers, and obviously Harden going nuclear in a couple of games, you know, really change the dynamics of the series. It does feel like one of those series that if the Celtics lose it, people are going to ask questions about late game execution. I mean, there were two very winnable games that they obviously blew, and especially game one, but also game four. And, you know, and so it'll feel like a series that probably the Celtics should have won if they lose, right? And not to take anything away from the Sixers. Still not feeling like, you know, they're as good of a team as your Boston Celtics. But
I've been very surprised by, I mean, I didn't think James Harden had one game like that in him anymore, much less two.
Yeah.
From game six, what really surprised me was I caught a little glimpse of some of Celtics Twitter, and I know any fan base followed by Twitter is not like maybe the where you want to be looking for your info. But before the fourth quarter, there was quite a bit of like kind of some negative Jason Tatum stuff. And if anyone in Boston is tired of the Jason Tatum experience, there's like 29 other fan bases that would love to have your problems.
Yeah.
I mean, are people totally down on Jason Tatum?
No.
Or are they just,
okay. I mean, that's absurd. I mean, of course, Boston Sports Radio goes after him all the time.
Right.
You know, I mean, if he hadn't ended the game six, the way that he did, obviously there would be a lot of questions that were asked. But no, people are not actually down on Jason Tatum. That's,
okay.
You know, that's absurd. I think people are very nervous about this team. And it goes back to last season and, you know, in game four of the finals last year, they had a late game lead. They could have gone up 3-1 on the Warriors, right? It really would have, if not ended that series, certainly they would have been in the driver's seat. And they blew it down the stretch and then totally collapsed the rest of the series. And there are real questions all through this season about their late game execution. I mean, and Tatum has been inconsistent at times, particularly with his shot. His shooting numbers are not as good this year as they have been in the past. They've declined, particularly you know, if you look at the stats that pull up threes, they're he's way down this season. You know, and there's a downward trend there. So you know, and a lot of the questions that people thought were answered by his game six performance against Milwaukee last year, where he scored, 46 on the road in what could have been an elimination game. Those questions have not been, they popped back up. You know, I think it wouldn't be the same way if they had won the finals last year. God, if the Sixers win game seven, it will excise, it will get rid of, you know, what is now 40 years of futility against the Celtics, literally 40 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I mean, they haven't beaten the Celtics in the playoffs since, was it 83? 80,
I think 83.
The LA game.
83.
The game seven at the Garden that the Sixers won. And, you know, and that's a terrifying thought for, you know, any Celtics fan. So, you know, in that sense, there's a lot riding on this game. Obviously, if the Celtics do win game seven, how would they rank among your title favorites going into the last?
I would certainly pick them over Miami. And I don't say that lightly. I know what Miami can do.
Yeah.
I don't think there's two things with this. I put Denver ahead of everyone.
Yeah.
Because I think, excuse me. I think Denver's combination of talent and continuity, especially, and coaching is probably the best right now of the teams who are left. Just talent. Those guys have all been together. Like, I mean, Jokic and Murray have been together now. It's got to be about 8 years. Porter Jr. has been there a while. They have home court. I mean, Denver's a tough place to play, period. I would say Denver's one. What strikes me the most about Boston is that, you know, one question mark, I don't follow them. I would be curious to hear what you think of this. The biggest question, like the biggest jump for me for the Knicks going from Cleveland to Miami was that the Knicks went from a series where Tom Thibodeau was clearly out coaching JB Bickerstaff, which is not shocking. JB Bickerstaff is much younger. He's less experienced. Tom Thibodeau probably should have the advantage. But once the Knicks matched up with Miami, Eric Spoelstra is as good as it gets. Yeah. There's no advantage there. I don't know Joe Mazzulla. I don't know what to make of him. I don't watch the Celtics nearly enough to understand, is he good? Is he helpful? Is he just kind of trying to do what Ime Udoka was already doing? So you're going into a game seven against Doc Rivers. Do you feel like your team is at a coaching disadvantage, advantage? Is it even? You keep talking about execution. Are there questions about Joe Mazzulla?
Sure. I mean, there are questions that have been asked. I think it's very hard for us to parse what's going on with the coaching staff over the course of a single season from the outside, right? So, I mean, obviously something happens like, you know, in game four with the problems with their execution at the end of the game. Mm-hmm. Inability to get a shot off. People are going to ask questions about that. Although, just to say, Marcus Smart had a pretty wide open three-pointer at the end of regulation that could have won it. If he had hit that, mm-hmm. you know, the discussion becomes totally different. Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff here about should they call timeouts, you know, more timeouts, that's a big thing that people ask. I don't know how much stock to put into that. You know, there are definitely moments like that one where I would have said, okay, well, probably you want to draw something up. On the other hand, there's an argument to be made for letting the game flow, you know, and letting
don't give the defense a chance to set up.
Give the defense time to set up and you know, keep things moving, move quickly, right? You know, and try and search out advantages in that way. The big thing that I do think is an issue, and we'll see how much this is solved, is that the scuttlebutt is that Mazzulla was very, very resistant to going back to the double big starting lineup with Rob and Al, right? Or that he was someone who was less inclined to do that. Not very resistant. That's the wrong way to put it. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But that he was not. So in game six, they made the lineup change, and the kind of rumors are there was a collective process to make that decision. He was not necessarily the driving force there.
Okay.
And that he has been more committed to a small lineup, in part because of how it changes the spacing offensively, right? You know, against the Sixers, mm-hmm. where you have that combination of shooting and playmaking. And Derek White has been great all season, right?
Yes,
so, you know, but I think it's clear that their defensive potential with the double big lineup goes to another level, right? Mm-hmm. If you can stick Rob Williams on PJ Tucker in the corner and let him help,
it
totally changes what the offense can do, you know, what the Sixers can do offensively in terms of getting into the lane. You know, it gives them a different kind of defensive potential. So
does it hurt them offensively to start Williams?
Say it again.
Does it hurt the Celtics offensively to start Williams alongside of Horford?
Yeah, probably. I mean, at this point in this season, the sample size is so small. Last year, during the regular season with the double big lineup, they just crushed teams both offensively.
They destroyed the whole league.
Yeah, in the playoffs when Rob Williams was clearly more banged up, you know, that it wasn't the same. There wasn't the same dynamic there, but. You know, but this year it's hard to say exactly what it does. You can imagine, I can imagine that, you know, look, if you have Marcus Smart, Derek White, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, and Al Horford, that's five shooters and five guys who can put the ball on the floor and make plays. I mean, Al Horford can put the ball on the floor and make plays off the dribble drive. And the you know, it presents some serious challenges to a team like Philadelphia that would like to play Joel Embiid next to the rim, obviously. Mm-hmm. Such a talent. He's so good defensively. He's such a talented rim protector. He moves so well, even though he's clearly not 100%, you know, 100% too. So, and, you know, and the ability of that unit to shoot the ball, you know, creates different kinds of complexities for a defense. Now that too, it's dependent on the Celtics hitting their shot. And I mean, you know, despite all the analysis, there's a lot to suggest that The main question every time the Celtics take the floor is, are they going to hit their three-pointers? And when they do, they win. And when they don't, they lose. Right? You know, and so, you know, yeah, I mean, a little bit, there's some randomness to that and some luck involved, I would say, right? You know, but if they are shooting the ball, then that lineup really it creates a lot of possibilities defensively. I'm just looking at the playoff stats for teams.
Okay.
So, you know, the number one offensive rating, 118.7, is Denver. The Celtics are second at 117.9 for the playoffs.
Hmm.
By the way, you know who is number five here at 115.7 is Miami, which is just interesting because that's a big jump from where they were in the regular season, right?
Yes. That, I think, came mostly against Milwaukee. They weren't putting up those kinds of numbers against the Knicks, really.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, the Knicks defense is, anyway, we'll talk about the Knicks in a second. But but just the Celtics have scored points in the playoffs, right? You know, they're capable of scoring points.
Is Celtics 76ers the Eastern Conference Finals?
No, I don't think so. I mean,
do you fear Miami if you advance?
Of course.
Okay.
Shouldn't everyone fear Miami?
I always feel like the Celtics have so, like, watching the Knicks play the Heat, it feels like one thing that you feel watching it is like, wow, like Miami seemed oddly more dangerous from three. When I think of the Celtics, I just think of them as being so explosive offensively. Maybe because I think of Tatum and Brown like so much that it's hard for me to imagine Miami just. Now, I was wrong about that against the Bucks. I did not think, because Miami couldn't shoot at all in the regular season, I didn't think Miami had any chance to score enough points just to keep up with the Bucks.
Yeah.
And they did. And then against the Knicks, they shot like they did in prior seasons. And like you described with Boston, when Miami makes their threes, they are really difficult. When they don't hit their threes, they kind of look like crap.
Can we just back up for a second? And I don't want to take us too far afield, but I haven't talked to you since the playoffs started. What the hell do you think happened to that Milwaukee team? What is your assessment of?
I think it's so. This is interesting to me because a lot of Knicks fans now are calling for Tom Thibodeau to be fired because, of course, there has to be a scapegoat for the season. And when I look at other teams like sites or newspaper stuff to find out like what do they have to say about their coaches, the complaint about almost every coach around the league is the same. Whether it's Steve Kerr and has had all the success that he's had, or whether it's some no-name like Stevens, you know, someone you've never heard of or doesn't have much of a history. The complaint is always that they're too stubborn. They don't make changes. Mike Budenholzer, this is the second time in, I think, 4 years that a prohibitive title favorite under him lost in the playoffs to Miami in a series where Jimmy Butler was going crazy and he refused to put Giannis Antetokounmpo on him. And in this series, and Giannis is like, I don't think this is throwing under the bus. I don't think Giannis is that kind of person. But Giannis was very clear after game 7 that he asked for, now I don't know why Giannis has to ask, but he's different culturally. Maybe he's different. That he asked to be put on Butler again, and he wasn't. And so Butler was torching Drew Holiday, which in and of itself is not easy to do. But Budenholzer has shown more than once he can be extremely slow to make an adaptation. And in that series, even with Giannis having the back problems that he did, even with the injury compromises that he had, they easily could have still won the series and maybe would have if you had put one of the three best defenders in the world against the one guy on the other team that can beat you by himself. And you even saw at the end of game, I think it was game 5 of that series.
Yep.
Where the Heat tie it at the end of regulation he pulls Brook Lopez. So it's Pat Connaughton, I think, against Jimmy Butler at the rim. Butler wins that matchup, throws in the shot to tie it. There's time to call timeout and advance the ball and get a drawn up play to try to win at the end of regulation. Instead, he lets his team inbound it with like half a second left. There is no shot. Now you have to go to overtime. I think now it was cold. I really did think it was cold, even by pro sports standards. that, like, literally a week after Budenholzer's brother dies, you fire him. And he is the, he is the only coach. Yeah. It happened, like, during that series. And now, whatever you want to say, it's sports. We see things like this happen. But I thought that was cold. But I do understand that there's not a big influx of talent coming there. The best option they have going forward probably is to hope that they can keep Middleton, who has a, I think, a player option that he probably won't take because it's like $40 million for a year. They don't have big opportunities to make huge changes, so they're probably going to have to keep that core together. To me, that said, like, maybe you can keep the guy who's already been there, but how many coaches can you remember in your lifetime who even once lost a playoff series because they wouldn't put their best defender on the guy torching them, and now he's done it twice? That's weird.
Okay, let me ask you a question. So I wow, the story about his brother is awful.
Yeah, very sad.
And I agree with what you're saying about lack of adjustments. It's clear that Budenholzer needed to go from that team. And they may need, I think they probably, if, I don't know what they'll do, but bigger changes need to be made in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. The stuff about, like, who is taking on the assignment, you know, who is guarding who, the reason that always seems overblown to me, and tell me what you think about this, and more for social media fodder than reality, is because in the modern NBA, if a team doesn't like a matchup offensively, they are just going to pick and pick and pick until mm-hmm. they get the matchup that they want. I mean, mm-hmm. you can put whoever you want on Jimmy Butler, and Miami is sophisticated enough that if they see someone on the court that they think would be a better matchup for Jimmy, they're going to go after that person. And the only way to deal with that is have a team that is flexible and switchable and big enough that, you know, there are no true weak links, right? I mean, that's the only way to deal with that. Is that wrong?
I don't think it's wrong, but I think you have to be selective about, like, you are trying as much as you can to dictate the terms. And if Miami wants to run, if Giannis is on Butler and they try to run a pick that is going to get him instead on Drew Holiday or someone smaller that he's killing, then at that point, Giannis is going to have to fight over the screen and you're going to have to double and force the ball out of Butler's hands, because your choices are either, well, I don't think Butler can keep doing this, or let's see if Max Strus beats us, or Gabe Vincent, or, and I can tell you, I watched the Knicks do that. It's not fun watching, you know, role players kill you with threes, but there's a point where you have to try to,
of course,
you know, take the act, not just react, not just hope. And I think you're right, especially now, because so much stuff is pick and roll and mismatch. Giannis starting on the possession absolutely doesn't mean that he's going to necessarily end it there, but, like, it's hard. It's a hard game. Make it happen. Or just try, you have to try something. When this is, I think every coach gets this. I know Thibodeau gets this. If something is obviously not working, do you go down with the ship, or do you try to change something?
Yeah.
It looks too often, I think, with him, like, and I think he suffers too from, I think this works against sometimes coaches who've had only good teams. Budenholzer was an assistant forever in San Antonio before he took over in Atlanta for a very talented team that Mike Woodson had brought up from a nothing team to, like, a pretty good 50-win team. So a guy like Budenholzer, unless he can win, if you remember, the Hawks were brilliant in those regular seasons. They had four All-Stars one year. Those are your Joe Johnson, Josh Smith, Horford, Kyle Korver, Jeff Teague. Like, great, great, great teams. I don't think anyone looked at them and thought,
great, 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 but very, very good. How about we
great,
say that?
Great, great regular season team. I'll say that. They would win 60 games in the regular season.
I remember.
And they won once, like, they had a crazy winning streak. They covered Sports Illustrated. But when it came down to the playoffs, we're just like with players. I think, like, Julius Randle gets this a lot. I think Julius Randle is a terrific all-NBA regular season player.
Yep.
He has had some struggles in the playoffs. That makes sense if you consider the fact that it's a higher level of competition. Like, it's going to be harder.
Yeah.
Not every player translates the same. I don't think every coach does either. And I'm not sure that Budenholzer does. I don't think most people think the Bucks broke through in 2021 because Mike Budenholzer leveled up as a coach. I think they won because Giannis was incredible.
Yeah, which is not wrong. You know?
Yeah, which is probably, true.
Look, he deserves credit for some of the things he's done. I mean, what he did for Brook Lopez's career.
Oh, God, yeah.
is just unreal. If you just put that in context, I mean, when I was
the most remarkable careers I've ever seen in any sport in terms of what the player was and what he turned into.
Yeah. Well, 10 years ago, Brook Lopez was a very good offensive center for the
strictly post up, low block.
Yeah. He was a low post player who he felt a little bit anachronistic, but he certainly added, a lot offensively to the Nets. He was, as I remember it, not considered a strong defender. That was not his reputation at all. If anything, he was seen as a bit slow and easy to take advantage of, by more athletic centers. That's, as I remember, that's it. That was his reputation. And then in his 30s, he turned into this defensive juggernaut. And the one of the defining big men of the,
a 3-point monster. He's a 3-point machine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, of this shooting big man, the stretch big era. So he really deserves a lot of credit for that. He never could fix Giannis's jump shot, but that probably is a lot to ask for anyone. And they have, they have an aging team that had some real holes. If you are relying, and I understand the Middleton injury stuff really hurt them, but the Bucks are an aging and clearly flawed team with a lot of holes, and real holes on, and obviously some of that had to do with Middleton's injury, and it seems like his sort of the decline, the end of his prime. But anytime you're relying on Grayson Allen to play major minutes for you, you got a problem. That's not – talk about a matchup to hunt. And then their lack of – I know Joe Ingles did some things for them, but their lack of wing depth, like real talent on the wing, seemed like it really caught up with them, in the end. And so it's I'm just saying it's not all on Budenholzer, and people can.
Oh no, I don't think that he had to go. Like, I don't think now that they've gotten rid of Mike Budenholzer, the future is bright for them. I think it's the usual. They're scapegoating the coach because Jrue Holiday is going to be 33 next year, and just got torched at what he's best at. Brook Lopez is going to be 35. Chris Middleton is already showing decline. He's going to be 32. Pat Connaughton, who I think of as young, he's 30. They don't have the only Buck. Let's see, the Buck this year, they didn't have a single player under 27 who played 1,000 minutes for them. They didn't even have a single they're top heavy with age, and they don't have a ton of flexibility, because they gave away a bunch of picks in the Holiday deal, and you can't argue with it. They won a title. It was worth it. Like, what they did, they got what they wanted. They won a title. But you see this from teams now. Like, they're going to be expensive. They don't have a lot of avenues to improve. But you can't just let Chris Middleton go, because you're not going to be able to just replace him. They're in a tricky spot, man.
In a tricky spot. They have some real questions to answer, and they're going to have some tough roster construction stuff. I gotta say, two things I was thinking. As long as they have Giannis, who's just right in his prime, it's totally possible for them to retool and be a 60-win team next year. I mean, that's 60 wins would be on the higher end, obviously. But I'm just saying it's not impossible at all. The other thing
More to me like one of those teams that, like an old, like a Phoenix, where you don't want to be trying to win 60 games. You want to make sure that win 48 and have a healthy Middleton when you get to the playoffs.
I mean, the thing I was thinking, if you look at the Lakers and the Heat in the conference finals this year, it really is. It's in the modern NBA, the regular season just doesn't matter at all. It turns out it doesn't matter as long as you get there.
Yep.
It turns out it doesn't matter even a little bit. It's sort of a depressing thing. We just spent the last, 6 months obsessing over you know, every twist and turn in the NBA season, and it turns out it's just not. It's not.
Friend of the pod, Howard Beck, just wrote a piece about that, about how all the, like, if you look at this season especially, like, it really, it's so crazy and chaotic. And I wrote something about it too a couple weeks ago for Fansided. Like, it seems like, and I guess this is why probably the NBA is looking, I think it's next season is when they're implementing, or is it the year after?
Mid-season tournament.
It's mid-season tournament. Like, they know, like, they don't want to give up the games because it's gate revenues, and it's, it lets them have a bigger TV package. But we see all the time now, like, this is a natural consequence of nationalizing your audience. You then reduce it to rings is all that matters, and if rings is all that matters, then the regular season doesn't matter either. So this is like what you get. I would say that it doesn't matter, I think, if you are an old veteran team like Milwaukee or a team like Phoenix or Golden State. But for some other teams, I think, for example, like for a team like the Knicks, this is an important, it was an important regular season because that's how they built patterns. That's how they, like, for where they were, it was important for them to have an 82 game regular season to, like, test themselves against. But I do think in general, if you're 2/3 of the league, you're either trying to win a title or you're trying to get a lottery pick. So how many of those games really mean anything?
Now that Bud is gone, do you think Quinn Snyder feels lonely as the most maniacal-looking, sleep-deprived-looking head coach to roam the sidelines? I mean, who looked crazier, Bud or Quinn Snyder?
Quinn Snyder has always had strong Joker vibes to me. Like, Quinn Snyder, like, is terrifying to me. Budenholzer is like you're dating a girl when you're like 22, and like one day her dad gets like really just over the top, irrationally angry, and you've never seen it before. To me, Budenholzer has that look. Budenholzer has the look of a parent who will surprise you at like a barbecue or a night where he's had a few too many, and it just makes you realize, like, I did not know this man could go there. He can look crazy, but like, he looks more resigned to his fate. Quinn Snyder looks like he will knife somebody by the end of the game.
It's really true. It's, oh my God.
It really does.
It is. It's the difference between resignation and you know, someone who looks like well, I don't want to malign Quinn Snyder.
Quinn Snyder's doing okay. You can say what you want. He's doing fine.
Real serial killer vibes. Okay, let's talk about I want to talk about the three other series, but we got to talk about Knicks Heat.
Yeah, so it's a tough day the day after, and it's tough because it's definitely a series that they could have won, but it's not a series that I ever thought they would win. Late last night, they were down 6 with about a minute left, and Gabe Vincent committed like in unforgivable flagrant foul when the Heat were inbounding up 6 on Jalen Brunson's face. The Knicks ended up getting 4 points out of it. Now they were down just 2. I did feel to the end like they will, I think they will be there to the end, and they were. But I think the Knicks, I'm struck by this, how many Knicks fans who all season rightfully praised, like, oh my God, look at what our young team is doing. Look at how ahead of schedule our young team is. Yes, all true. Your young team just ran into one of the more veteran, savvy, top-level competitors of the last 4 years. This is the 3rd year in 4 that the Heat are in the conference finals. I think only Boston is on that level. So it's a very weird feeling to me. I don't know if this is age. I don't know if I have more perspective or less energy. I don't know which one it is. I'm not bothered, like, at all. I'm disappointed that they lost because it's been fun to watch them. But I have nothing but positives to take away. I'm not one of these fans today who's like, Tom Thibodeau has to be fired. Julius Randle has to be traded. Like, I'm not there at all. It was an incredible, really arguably the most pleasantly surprising season I have ever seen from this team. And I've been watching them since, like, 1990. The fact that they had this success, the fact that it's built predominantly on their youth, the fact that they still have a workable cap situation, plenty of extra draft picks. Like, they might get Dallas's if they drop on I think it's Tuesday when they draw the lottery. Like, Brunson, Jalen Brunson has been the biggest positive. I've never seen a player that I was more wrong about in terms of, I thought, I was talking to someone about this on another pod last week. I thought Jalen Brunson for the Knicks would turn out to be like a slight upgrade over what Raymond Felton was, like a pretty good point guard, like a solid point guard. I thought Brunson would get you like 16 and 6 and like stabilize the position.
Yeah.
Jalen Brunson is the Jalen Brunson this season had a better season than any Knick has had since Patrick Ewing in 1997. That includes Carmelo, all the Carmelo years. That includes everybody. I have never seen a player surprise me this much in terms of, holy shit, I didn't know you were that guy. Like, and I feel fine because nobody did. Even the Knicks didn't when they got him. If they thought he was more than this, they wouldn't have paid him $25 million. They would have paid him $35 million.
I mean, he really has – it's remarkable, the player that he has evolved into and, you know, what he managed to do for them offensively. And, you know, actually the thing I find most impressive about him is – you know, his ability to drive into the lane and into traffic, given how short he is, you know, and people, it's kind of incredible. I mean, he's clearly very solid, right? He's got like a solid build, but he had a bad late game turnover last night.
He did.
Yeah, when he was going into the lane and he got doubled and he tried to split the D and make
which happens, I think, when you play all 48 minutes on Wednesday and play 40 something again on Friday against a defense that is sending two or three people at you every time you dribble the ball.
Okay, let me ask you this question. First of all, Tibbs is clearly, he's really solidified his position as the coach of this team going forward. Yes, like,
depends who you talk to.
Okay.
There is definitely a feeling that for some people, and I like, the Rangers always matter in relation to the Knicks because it's the same owner. The Rangers just fired their head coach after a couple of very impressive regular seasons because the way they lost in the playoffs this year to the Devils was so disheartening that the owner decided that means more than the success. Whether you agree or not, that's up to you, but that's where the owner is at right now. And he's done this before with both franchises. He did it with he did it in the past with Mike Woodson. And he did it in the past also with various different Ranger coaches, like whoever you want to pick, Tom Rennie, Vigneault. But the point is, you would think Tom Thibodeau is probably safe because he's been there three seasons. He's giving you two very positive seasons. The young players have developed under him. You don't hear any public complaining ever about Thibodeau. People seem to support him. Players who love him, the players who talk about him generally speak very positively about him. But there is a faction who believe, and it is fair, if you go back to Thibodeau's history in Chicago and Minnesota, and someone wrote about this, I think maybe it was Fred Katz wrote about this today in The Athletic. There are certain continuities to Thibodeau teams that suggest like there's a ceiling because they all end up doing kind of similar things. Like Chicago, Minnesota, New York, his best teams, they're really good at offensive rebounding. They finish well in net rating, but there's a limit. Thibodeau is like a guy who gets your house in order, but he doesn't get it. He doesn't transcend beyond that. And so the thinking against Thibodeau is this: maybe this is his ceiling, because it seems to be with almost every team he's been with, they get around to this point, but then he doesn't have the either flexibility or the just the extra 5%, whatever it is that special coaches have, that get them beyond this point. So there is an argument that if you hired him knowing his history and you see now that he's gotten you basically to what you would have guessed, this is what I could ask of Tom Thibodeau, then is it fair now to say, okay, let's be proactive as an organization. Let's recognize maybe Thibodeau doesn't have another gear. Maybe Randall doesn't have another gear. Let's not wait to find out. Like, let's move while we can. My question with that, and this isn't a reason not to do it, but I don't see the obvious, like, okay, we're going to fire Thibodeau and we're going to bring in Coach X, who is clearly and obviously an upgrade. I can't think of who that is right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, who possibly could replace him? I mean, is the issue that Tibbs doesn't have another gear, or is the issue that this roster needs some upgrades, particularly offensively? I mean, they looked like a really strong defensive team in the playoffs, right? But
they did, which is odd because their strength in the regular season was more the offense. But even that, I mean, they had the third, or depending on what ranking you go with, they were third or fourth in offense. But it's really curious because they're not a good shooting team. So what happens is Thibodeau's dogmas at some point seem to run into a wall. So, for example, Mitchell Robinson had a tremendous season, like worth everything they paid him and more. Probably the best offensive rebounder in the league, and also an incredible defensive presence. But one could make the argument at this point that there's a limit to what you can do with offensively when you have a center who cannot shoot from outside the paint at all. And none of the Knicks centers shoot from outside the paint. But Thibodeau always wants a center on the floor. So for 48 minutes under Tom Thibodeau, you have to have a center who can't shoot. You're going to have Randle there 40 minutes a game. He is a streaky shooter, but he's not a pure shooter. RJ Barrett is not a pure shooter. Jalen Brunson is not a pure shooter. These are guys who tend to get what they get one-on-one in difficult situations. If you're going to play that many people together and there's not really a lot of shooting, there is a limit, as we see in the playoffs, to what you can do. If you had a center who was more of a 3-and-D type, you know, even a Brook Lopez, now you can play face-up with five people. It opens up lanes for Barrett. It gives Randle and Brunson, who both love to work inside the arc, more room. But Thibodeau is not going to do that, because to Tom Thibodeau, your center does this, and he has to do like this. So I would say this season the most pleasant surprise to Thibodeau was that he showed more flexibility than he ever has, going to lineups that he wouldn't go to in the past, playing the kids more. But I would say the indictment is that the only time that tends to happen is when Thibodeau's hand is forced. So, like, he has to play Randle and Obi Toppin together for a couple of nights because all his centers are hurt. But does he stick with it afterwards? Not generally. You know, I don't know. I don't. My thing is, you have to know yourself. You have to be aware of yourself.
Yeah.
The Eastern Conference Finals are very likely, I would say very likely, to be Boston and Miami. Philly could win, whatever. Yeah, but Philly, Boston and Miami, you're hard-pressed to find two organizations who are steadier from the top on down than those two. And for the Knicks, to me, to have their best year in 10 years, 25 years, and right after that season say, you know what we should do? Fire the coach and trade our two-time All-NBA player. To me, that reeks of, you have internalized Jim Dolan's madness, and you probably should not be let anywhere near a phone.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fine line between realizing that you have to make, you know, some changes.
Sure.
You know, if you're the Pistons, you have to trade Adrian Dantley, kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And then what you're saying, making changes just in a reactive way and, you know, without any real forethought or...
It's just on the same level with Thibodeau. Now you see people today, and this has been going on a bit, you see people crying out for, oh.
Sorry.
No, I understand his anger. I feel very similarly.
Hold on 1 second. Sorry.
Yeah, you're good. I mean, he's just anticipating the point that I'm about to get into. Jacobin Sports Show is sponsored by a dog that sounds not thrilled.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're all good. So, like, what I've seen today, and again, this is just day after fan reaction, but it does point to a mentality that exists. Now you see a lot of people saying, like, oh, the Knicks got to trade Randle. You know who the Knicks should get? They should get Damian Lillard. Okay, let's say they get Damian Lillard. Where is he playing? You're going to start him next to Jalen Brunson and have two guards who are, like, 6'1". That's the level of like reaction where like it's not, there's no, you just want to, it's like a bodily reflex. Like,
yeah,
we lost. We have to do something. I don't think you do. I'm not saying the Knicks right now have everything they need to win a title because they don't. But I think of the Raptors before they won, where everybody wanted them to blow up that team for years.
Sure.
And they held together a pretty good core until Kawhi Leonard was available. And then they won.
And then they traded, one of their two best players.
Yeah. But they stayed with it enough that there was enough of an accumulation of talent that there was something to be done there. Phoenix, pretty good team. Then they were able to make a deal for Chris Paul. Didn't work for them this year with Durant, but it's the same now that they have a full offseason to let's put an actual team together. The thing with the Knicks is that because for so long the ideology has been we need a star. Before we do anything, we have to trade for our Messiah. That's one way to build that doesn't usually work. But another way that works is you accumulate talent, you let it gel, you let it get experience together. And then at the highest level of competition, the playoffs will show you what you actually need.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I would be remiss if I did not take the opportunity to talk to you about one of your favorite talking points, which is a successful Los Angeles Laker team advancing to the Western Conference Finals. LeBron James, Anthony Davis certainly have a shot. They may not be favored against Denver, but they're not to be. They beat them in the bubble, which was obviously not the same as a normal season. But I didn't hate the Heat like I normally do this year. I don't have any reason to hate these particular players, except I think Kyle Lowry is a dick. But you've had a very strong, well-earned, I would say, Laker feeling throughout your life. Do you hate these Los Angeles Lakers?
I don't know, man. Of course, I always hate the Lakers. Always. for sure. There's never a circumstance in which I don't hate the Lakers. What was interesting, last night was such a Lakers game for this. Now, they shot the ball really well from three. They did not take a lot of threes. They took 26. They were 13 for 26. It's interesting, isn't it? They went to the free throw line 42 times.
Killed them at the line. They killed them all series at the line. It was like watching a dad play against his son. He was just taking him down in the paint and boom, boom, boom.
Anthony Davis is a really great player. Right? So he's really good, and the Warriors couldn't do anything against that. Against that defense, which also just looked like an absolute juggernaut in this series, didn't they? The Lakers defense looked amazing.
A healthy and an active AD is a complete 180 for a team. Like, completely changes what they look like.
Completely changes. It's going to be so fascinating to watch this Western Conference Finals with the matchups, given how good Denver's offense has looked, given what Jokic has been able to do.
It's incredible.
In every facet of the game. That's going to be a great matchup. I really am. I'm really curious to see how that plays out and to see the presumably Aaron Gordon on LeBron, if the Lakers come back as an 8 seed and win the title this year.
Well, don't worry. They're only the 7 seed.
That's right, a 7 seed.
Miami's the 8 seed.
Yeah, right.
Have you begun to prepare emotionally at all for the possibility of a Lakers-Celtics series when I believe they've won the same number of titles now? So it would be for the most titles ever if they meet. Have you thought that far ahead yet or no?
People are going to think that I'm being ridiculous about this, and I don't want to get into a social media debate. But, and I understand the response is going to be, oh, well, the Celtics won so many of their titles in the 60s, small league, blah, blah, blah. People want to dismiss Bill Russell's titles. That's fine. But the Lakers, you can't just go back and claim the 5 titles that were won in Minneapolis, which they just started to do. Well, like a couple decades ago, suddenly those became their title. If that's true, then Oklahoma City has won an NBA championship, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because the Seattle Supersonics. You can't have it both ways. I don't. I genuinely think that's I think that's important. You know, the George Mikan titles belong to Minneapolis, not to the Lakers. And
so, do they go to the Timberwolves, or are they just kind of like floating in the ether?
They're floating in the fucking ether. They're floating. I mean, what's bullshit is that when they moved to LA, they obviously should have changed the name of the franchise. It doesn't make any sense, you know. Right. It's like the Utah Jazz.
Exactly.
Like
what? Or the Memphis Grizzlies.
Or the Memphis Grizzlies, right? Yeah, Memphis, famous for its bears, the wildlife. You know, yeah, really, the tundra of Memphis.
Right.
Yeah, so, okay, I'm not emotionally prepared for that. That would be very difficult to take. That also, just to say, not to think way too far ahead, obviously, that would be a fascinating matchup, too, just as an NBA, from an NBA fan perspective. The Celtics and the Lakers. I mean, the Celtics would have to just be going bombs away, right? I mean, they would try and shoot 53s every game. This is pointless speculation.
There's still the Sixers to deal with, first of all, before we worry about the Lakers. But it's fun to think about. It's fun to think about.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting to think about. By the way, do you think Phoenix is screwed? The Suns are screwed. Do they have a path forward? No.
I think they're going to trade Chris Paul, and I think they're in that position where veterans are going to want to come play there. Like, good veterans are going to want to come play there on short deals because they've already got Durant and Booker. They took a step back this year, I think, to take a step forward. They had no depth after all their deals were made. And unfortunately for them, I mean, Chris Paul wasn't looking like Chris Paul anyway, but if they are ruthless, which they should be at this point, I think that they caught a break in seeing that with Paul out and the ball in Booker's hands more, like, you're just a more dangerous team. The more that your best player has the ball in his hands, the better you're going to be. And you don't need a Chris Paul type point guard. Like, you can get, you know, get yourself a nice 3-and-D, like an actual 3-and-D point guard. Get yourself, I think they're going to make a couple of big moves. I think Chris Paul is going to go. I think DeAndre Ayton has to go at this point. There's so much obvious public crap between him and Monty Williams and the team. Like, he's got to go. And I don't think he makes that big of a difference for them. Like, I think they're going to make moves. I'm very interested to see what their roster looks like going into next season, because I think people are going to want to play there if they can.
That's interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll see.
I got to go walk this dog, man. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, you're good. You're good. You want to say goodbye then for now?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Let me, Jonah Birch doing his civic duty, taking a dog out because dogs cannot take themselves out. So we're going to thank Jonah Birch for joining us today. Always grateful to have his presence on the pod.
Maybe we'll do an update tomorrow after game 7.
That's fine with me. I'd be happy to hear where you are emotionally 24 hours from now, especially if the Celtics win. And also, maybe I'll slide in a couple Liverpool questions for you as well, since we haven't been able to talk about that in a while. But for now, there may be more tomorrow, and if there is, we'll add it on and you won't need to listen to this. But if we don't, please remember to follow Jacobin Sports Show on Twitter at Jacobin Sports. Email us, jacobinsports@gmail.com. Patreon, please remember, subscribe to the Patreon. Convince people to subscribe to the Patreon. Buy it for them as a gift. Strongly encourage them to think about their life choices. It helps them. It helps me. Patreon.com/Jacobin Sports Show. That is it for this episode, unless we talk to Jonah again tomorrow. But one way or the other, we will talk to you again soon, everybody.